This week's show with Sarah Pedlow of Threadwritten is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery, home of Sassafras Samplers. In 2022, the folks at Sassy Jack's are planning to release a Sassafras Sampler chart each month. To see many of the upcoming samplers, watch the March 9 Fiber Talk Stitch Hour, in which Kim Young and Susan Greening Davis tell us about those samplers. As we await the opening of the new Sassy Jack store in a couple of months, visit sassyjackstitchery.com for all of your needlework needs and to sign up for several live classes and workshops that will be offered in the coming months. Thanks to Sassy Jacks for sponsoring the show, and now on to our conversation with Sarah Pedlow. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Amsterdam, Sarah Pedlow. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, Threadwritten. Threadwritten is the website you want to go to, but then there's also sarahpedlow.com, which is a whole nother world of art, which we will explore.
Yes.
Yeah, you got to have a little more going on, Sarah, because you're boring.
Yes, never a dull moment in my household.
All right, now the first thing I got to know about is the family vacation art contest.
Oh,
that sounds like a blast!
What a nice place to start. Yes, I would credit my dad starting a family art contest on our vacations when I was growing up as part of the beginning of my interest in and motivation in art, to be an artist. Every summer we would go. So I grew up in the Bay Area in Santa Rosa, California, which is about an hour north of San Francisco. And we would take a vacation to Carmel in the summer and spend about a week there and relax and just walk to the beach. And there are several hobby artists in my family, including my great aunt and uncle, and they would always come on vacation with us. They were both painters. And my dad had taken a lot of art classes for fun at the community college. And my mom also does some drawing. And so my dad developed this art contest, and there would be a theme every year that was related to the place. I think the first couple years, the theme was sea otters, which was my favorite animal at the time, and birds of Monterey County, architecture, all sorts of things just related to the place that we were staying. So it was a lot of fun. So he was the judge, and he also entered. I believe he won one year, and he provided prizes, which were always really funny. It was like a matching set of luggage, and it was a whole set of grocery bags.
Okay.
You know, that kind of thing, a car, and of course it was a toy car, things like that. So so it was a lot of fun.
So that's because that really kind of gets to the crux of it. Growing up as a child with art, I mean, you know, so many children grow up with whatever activity it is, and then by the time they're adults, they've had enough of it. But this was just a fun environment of creativity then.
Yes, exactly. Both my parents took me to museums and were very interested in supporting my creativity in any way. So yeah, part of it was always the preparation, making my entries for this contest in July every year, and taking other art classes and doing whatever they could to help me be creative and expressive.
And that, obviously that carried over into your schooling, because you stuck with art all the way through.
I did, yeah.
You just have
I
that natural orientation to art that drove you?
I think so, yeah. But I also think there's something inside of me that just reacts to being in the presence of art as well as making it. I remember going to the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco and just feeling good being surrounded by a room of paintings, seeing all of the color and the texture and the different kinds of mark making. And that was really an inspiration, you know, looking for that feeling, which years later has changed to be focused about textiles in the same way, right? It's visiting museums and seeing traditional clothing and traditional embroidery and getting that same feeling of like, wow, I feel so good when I see this work and I want to know more. So,
yeah, because that was the other thing I was curious about your early years is you're obviously exposed to just about any kind of art you want. And then mm-hmm. what is it that sends you down the textile path?
Yeah, so the textile work, the sewing and embroidery work skipped a generation with my mom. So my grandmother sewed clothing for my mom and my aunt, and she did a bit of embroidery, but I never really saw any of it. And I guess her mother also embroidered a lot as well. And I learned more about this after my grandmother passed away. So my mom, just was never really interested in handwork or sewing. So I didn't get any training beyond a little bit as a Girl Scout, you know, some brownie activities.
Get that badge. Get that badge.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So I had been interested in textiles. I had been interested in, so really photography was, you know, beyond the art contest, photography was my first love as an artist. And so I did a lot of black and white photography in high school and then focused on photography and mixed media work when I was in college. And then when I was in graduate school, I did installation work in mixed media. And so several years after I got my MFA, I did an artist residency in Budapest. And I was there to do photo mixed media. So I was mostly taking pictures in the city and, yeah, thinking about what to do with those images. And then one day I thought, I wonder what the traditional crafts are like. Maybe I'll go to the Ethnographic Museum and see. And so I went into the museum and turned the corner into the textile display of the traditional clothing. And really that changed everything because I saw embroidery in a way that I had never seen before. I never knew existed. So all of the just elaborate fine stitching on clothing from the different regions of Hungary with, you know, eyelets and the particular floral patterns that have become so emblematic of Hungary and Hungarian culture, like the tulip and the rose from the Matyo tradition, and incredible coats. They have these, you know, wool coats and sheepskin coats that are all embroidered. And that was another experience, like going back to the museum in San Francisco, of just feeling so good, feeling really energized by all of this color and pattern and these pieces with a real history to them. Like thinking about the hours and hours of work going into making a garment like this that one would wear for their wedding, or something that someone might be buried in, and all of the symbolism within that, right? Stitching this particular rose or this particular tulip because it signified who you were, you know, what village you were from, even what family you were from, and seeing at what point in life was this the garment of a young girl or a widow, all of the information held in these textiles is so fascinating. So that was really the beginning of it. I had thought a little bit about surface design and had been interested in pattern, color and pattern in general, but walking into that museum was really it for me.
It sounds like the history almost is a 1A aspect of this.
It is. I'm really interested in the history, in connecting with the past, and you know, kind of finding our place today by connecting with who came before us and what they made, and using that, I think, to give us strength, to give us a context for where we are now, and just a richer experience to have to move into the future.
You mentioned the artist residencies, and that we've had other people mention those, but never have asked what is an artist residency? What is the goal of that?
So an artist residency is a program that's designed to give artists time and space to make their work. So okay. They're really wonderful. There are many that are paid, and there are many that are unpaid. So often you will just be given, you know, a month's stay at a certain location, and you go and you have a studio space and, you know, a place to sleep. And sometimes in larger programs, they have food available, so you don't even have to cook. You're really just there to focus on your work. And they have them for people who are artists, writers, you know, spanning the arts.
So it's kind of an immersion thing then.
Yes, exactly. So time when you don't have to be working your day job or teaching or doing whatever you do to pay the bills and doing your artwork, you can just focus.
And then do they typically expect you to produce something, or can you really just dig yourself in and enjoy your art, and if nothing comes out of it, obviously there's something because you learn, you develop, but or are you expected to do some kind of an exhibition at the end?
It varies. Sometimes they ask you to leave a piece of work with them for their collection. Sometimes you are there with the purpose of creating work for an exhibition or putting up a show at the end. And sometimes it's just open-ended and there are no parameters. You can just go and spend the time however you see fit.
Hmm.
I see a lot of them advertised for, like, in Europe. Does the United States have?
Yes, definitely. There are many programs in the United States. The first one that I did was in Vermont, at the Vermont Studio Center. That was in between my first and second year of graduate school. And they're really great too, because if you're in a program with a group of artists, it's a wonderful way to meet other people and share your practice and make connections with other artists.
Right.
So the Ethnographic Museum, that's really your big turning point. And you didn't just dump photography. I mean, you still do that, right? But
yes,
it took a back seat though after that trip.
Well, I actually started working with photographs and stitching through photographs while I was there in 2009. So I did a couple pieces, and then I did a little bit more after I got back, but then I really switched my focus to going on the search to find women who do Hungarian written embroidery, which is called írásos in Hungarian, which translates to written, the word written. So I had, in the museum, there was quite a large display of work from this particular part of Hungarian Transylvania. So Transylvania, Romania, that was originally part of Hungary. And so that particular style really stuck with me. And I had been doing the artwork, and I just kept thinking about that embroidery with its really bold, graphic, thick lines and particular floral patterns. And so I just thought, I wonder if anybody is still doing that today. And I would love to go meet them and try to learn from them and support what they're doing and share their work. And so 3 years later, I took my first trip to Transylvania, Romania. And actually, I started out in Hungary. I went back to Hungary, went back to Budapest and did some traveling, and then went over to Transylvania and was able to connect with a woman who had done some embroidery. She actually ended up studying ethnography and craft later in life. And her husband was a traditional wood carver. So I feel like I got so lucky to meet her and stay with her. You know, we've become friends. And now whenever I go back, I stay with her and her husband. Because walking into their home for the first time was really like entering a small museum, because they had the traditional stove with the green ceramic tiles that you would see in old homes. Their walls were covered with textiles and wood carvings. Her husband would make art, essentially, like carved scenes of the local countryside and the local churches, and they were hanging on the walls. So it was really, such a wonderful experience to get a taste of what their life was like, and that as an entry point into the culture there.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that I really like about what you do, is when you look at particularly Europe, all the, you know, the occupations and shifting borders and blah, 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 and all that. But underneath all of that are these cultures and these regions where people have their own practices. And the way you tap into that and draw it out and keep it alive in many ways, I'm sure a lot of it is just literally dying off as people pass away, to keep these old things alive and bring them to light and show them to people and teach them is a real mission, if you will. But I really admire it, because I just hate to see that old stuff die away. It's like I hate to see old buildings get torn down. Jeez, you know, can't mm-hmm. you figure out how to keep that going?
I couldn't agree more. Especially with when I think about the women who I was later able to meet, who are doing this work. Yeah, yes, this work is just going to be in museums in the not too distant future when they're gone, because younger people there are not learning how to do it. So that really is my mission, is to preserve the culture and the skills and try to help more people learn that this is out there, and that, yes, there are all of these microcultures, which are so beautiful and so layered. There's so much to learn.
So when you enter an area, a scene, and you find someone who does, you know, the old traditional needlework, are they anxious to share with you? Do you have to pull it out of them? Do their friends start coming out of the walls to join in? What's that like?
Yeah, usually people are very excited to share what they do. And I think it's such a special thing to have someone pull something out of the closet or take something off their bed and to show it to you and see the pride on their face as they show their work. And, you know, talk about how they made it or when they made it, or, you know, if this was an heirloom piece from their grandmother.
Well, I think we all have pride in our needlework. And I know when I traveled Israel, we went into someone's home and it was kind of a little awkward at first. And then I noticed she had some sort of stitching. And I immediately, you know, I couldn't speak to her, you know, speak English, but it's immediately this connection. And we started, you know, trying to communicate, trying to share. And so she started pulling things out that she had, because I was obviously very excited about her needlework. And again, you make that connection. I think we, those of us who do stitching, there's always that connection there with other people. You don't need to know the language even. You know, we have a love for it and we want to share it.
Yes, for sure. For sure. I feel like now when I travel, I always ask people if their mother or their grandmother embroidered. And it's just, for me, the best way to try to connect. And because then it seems like it, even if it leads to something else, it's an entry point about, you know, creativity and craft and heritage. And so oftentimes people will say no, but then they'll say, oh, well, she used to knit, or she did this, or she did that. And it always opens up a good conversation.
Right. Now, do you find that young people then in these countries aren't carrying on the craft?
Usually not, in my experience. No. In fact, my first or second trip there. On my first trip, I was basically asking, you know, whoever I met, who I thought had a Hungarian sounding name, if they knew anyone who did this particular style. And so I asked a woman at the desk of the little guest house that I was staying at. And she said, oh, you know, my mother used to do that. And she's getting rid of her work. She's cleaning out her closet.
Oh, no.
And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, people are throwing this stuff away. This is, you know, terrible, right? But what also I think about what I own, right? And like at a certain point, what are you going to do with, you know, piles and piles of projects, right? But she ended up calling her mom and then sending me over to her mom in a taxi. And her mom gave me a couple pillowcases she had made, which was such a gift. It was so, so great. I kept saying thank you over and over again in Hungarian, because I didn't have, you know, my Hungarian language skills are slim to none. So I did take some lessons with a tutor for a while, but it's such a challenging language. So the woman who sent me her daughter, she is not stitching. I asked her if she did any stitching, and she said no. I started out Threadwritten making products with a handful of women who do this embroidery work. So we were collaborating on designing and doing these embroideries that I would then have sewn into bags and pillows back in the Bay Area.
Let's use Hungarian written embroidery as an example. Because Threadwritten, that's the name comes from, right, from Hungarian written embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
Take us through that, just that one technique and one microculture, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the thread work itself, the designing, the history behind it, but then also how you got yourself into this and learned it. And I'm sure the language barrier was an issue, but I got to believe it's like musicians, you know, the notes are the same, so we can at least communicate that way. Take us kind of through that whole thing so that we can get a sense of how you enter one of these microcultures and learn these techniques.
So it always...
That's a load, I realize, but...
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. So it always starts with a lot of research, right? Just trying to figure out where am I going, first of all? So how do I find the work that I've just discovered, and how do I find people? So a lot of research, and then, you know, going to the place. So finding out that written embroidery comes from what's now Romania, a place that I never thought I would visit. And have now been, I think, six times, and am going back, of course. So, so going to Romania. So I, you know, was lucky to find this couple who spoke some English. And once I was there the first time, the woman, my host, took me around to show me the different villages, and she grew up in the area, so she knew a lot of people. So she would introduce me to, you know, this woman who had been doing sewing, or this person, or the pastor of the local church, and that kind of thing. So I got a feel for the area with her. But in that trip, I kind of came back empty-handed. I didn't really see a lot of high-quality work. I think people were stitching to try to sell pieces to tourists, and so there were a lot of gaps between stitches. But I met a lot of people who said, oh, you know, come back in the fall after people have been in the fields working in the gardens and that kind of thing. I was there in June the first time. So they said, come back in the fall after all that is over, and people are getting ready for winter. And so I did. So I came back, and through meeting some other people and leading me to other people, I managed to meet a British couple who run a foundation in the area. And so they ended up being my main connection with the women who stitch, and were really instrumental in communicating and distributing materials, and just finding them to begin with. So that's how I got started. And we made products together for a couple years. And during that time, I learned the basic stitch from them, and it's a type of chain stitch. So this particular style is known for being all one color, all blue, red, black, or white traditionally. And it consists of this thick line that makes up floral patterns. And the patterns come from the Turkish influence in the area in history. And you can see some kind of like Renaissance and Baroque patterns, and with a tulip and a rose that repeat. And so it's really mostly just this one stitch that's used throughout, with a couple other decorative additions to it. So it's simple on one hand, but also not simple at all on the other hand.
Well, it looks, visually, it looks very heavy. It looks like it's fairly thick thread on fairly heavy cloth. Is that accurate, or is it just the way it comes across in the photos?
No, that's very true. It's it stands apart from what we think of, I think what most people think of as traditional embroidery, because it is a thicker thread. It's a more like a fingering weight yarn, and on a mid to heavy weight linen or hemp originally.
And so everybody, is it the same stitch for everybody, and everybody follows the same thing, or do we get variations? Do we get these rebels who have to go do something different?
Well, yeah, there are variations within the area in terms of the patterning and the way the stitch is done, and sometimes the material used. Now at the markets, you sometimes see pieces that are stitched with acrylic thread, and the look of the stitch is a little bit different than the style that I have chosen to focus on, which comes from the Kalotazeg region. And they use this type of chain stitch, and sometimes there's a way to do the stitch where the women that I worked with would say it's, you know, it's cheating if you do it the other way. If you vary the stitch and you make it a little bit easier, it's not the real thing. But, they're the purists of the tradition.
Well, yeah, that was the other part I was wondering about. Is it... obviously there's, I mean, there's a purist in every group, but it does, is that prevalent throughout in that, no, Sarah, this is the way it's done and done properly. And if you don't do it this way, then, yeah, like you say, you're cheating. I mean, are they pretty insistent that you stay with the old world style?
It really varies. People that I met, so I worked with women in two different areas, and women who were living in an area that's, you know, a couple hours away, they were actually more insistent on sticking with tradition. So they didn't want to stitch in colors that were not traditional, whereas the women from the region itself, with particular individuals, they were fine with using gray or, you know, using another color. So I think, I think it just varies, personal taste and beliefs.
They'd been using the same colors forever and they're tired of them. Moving on.
Yeah, I think so.
Give me a yellow, please.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So now most of this stitching is done on clothing for special occasions when they haul out the traditional dress to celebrate a festival or something. This is not everyday wear, is it?
So this particular style, the written embroidery, is mostly used on home textiles now. It was used a little bit on clothing originally, like on vests. And I've seen a couple pieces like that, but nowadays, and even when you visit museums, you mostly just see pieces that look like long tapestries that would have been hung in a church or part of the dowry display or tablecloths, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people in these villages, they still have what's called a formal room where they keep all of their traditional clothing and their painted furniture and pottery. And, so they have a room dedicated to that. That's, you know, kind of like what our formal living room would be, right? Where we receive guests and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So they have all of that on display there.
Mm. I bet that's a sight to behold.
It sure is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was most intrigued, of course, the Ukrainian people on our minds a lot these days, but most intrigued by the Ukrainian work and the mourning blouses.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole tradition there. I just love these old traditions where whether it's a wood carving or needlework or whatever it is, and just a way of signifying things in history and remembering them and keeping them from fading into history. And
yes, I spent about a week in Lviv in the western part of Ukraine in 2017, and I was studying with an embroidery teacher and working with a translator. And so I got a taste of embroidery from that part of the country. And I was particularly interested in the Borshiv tradition, which comes from an area that's kind of a little bit southeast, basically, from Lviv. And that tradition is incredible. I had plans to return to study more and to actually go to Borshiv, but yeah, we'll see when that's possible. It's my heart has been heavy considering what's going on there now. So, this Borshiv tradition is amazing. It's again a very thick stitch that becomes three-dimensional, similar to the Hungarian written embroidery made with yarn and mostly done in black. And there are a couple different stories about the origin of the black, why using black thread mostly over the years. And there's one theory that says it was a way to remember all of the men who died when the Tatars ransacked the area between the 15th and 17th centuries. So they vowed for, I think, seven generations to only stitch in black. So, yeah.
That's a commitment. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it isn't true, it's a wonderful story for tradition as to why they're using that color. You know, it's neat to remember because, you know, as we forget our history sometimes. So it tells you, it reminds you of that back history of something that happened in the past.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's what's so cool is you're exactly right, Beth. We forget our history and in a lot of cases intentionally, and the work that you're doing, Sarah, just you know, keeping that alive and visible and maintaining these techniques. Do you take steps to make sure that you've recorded how each of these various techniques is done so that you know, as people pass away, that it's not lost? I mean, are you creating some kind of an archive?
Yes, I did actually in 2014, I created a video of two of the women stitching in the written technique. And so I have started doing that. And it's definitely something I plan to do more of as a way to document these stitches and these traditions. And I do a lot of photography as I'm traveling as well. So that's important to me, is taking photographs of people and documenting the stitchers and the work itself and just kind of the feel of the place, you know, the setting, the home, the material culture that surrounds all of this.
Well, that was the thing in the photos, when you see the people in their traditional dress, obviously they're fixed up and they're showing off, but there seems to be an inner pride in wearing the clothing and being part of that. And I just really sense that, at least, you know, just maybe it's just made up in my mind, but there just seemed to be an extra sense of pride when they had those clothes on that came through in their expressions.
It's very true. It's very true. And I've done similar work in Portugal, in northern Portugal, learning from an embroiderer there and also taking people on retreat to learn to embroider, to experience the culture. We, at that retreat in the north, we attend a big festival, which is celebrating the patron saint of the city. It happens once a year. And it is, it's an ultimate expression of that pride, just to be around people having a big party with parades. And one of the parades that we attend has over 600 women dressed traditionally. Wow. Walking through the streets, and that is just, it's amazing to see that.
Flood of color, I imagine.
It is. Yes, definitely. So many bright colors and woven aprons and embroidered sleeves and, you know, printed scarves with paisley designs. And it's really a feast for the eyes.
Now, I did pick up, there was one or two photos I saw where there was also some traditional clothing for men, not as vibrant and elaborate, but there is that also for men in these mm-hmm. cultures.
Yes, definitely. Many times the men's dress is a little bit less elaborate, but then there are also times where it's not. I'm thinking about the Hungarian Matyo traditional clothing, where the men have a blouse with a sleeve that is absolutely huge, that has embroidery and crochet on the cuff. Like in Portugal, for instance, The men's clothing will have a little bit of red cross stitch with kind of a leaf pattern on it. And a little bit of ornamentation, but yeah, usually it is the women's dress that is much more elaborate.
You mentioned cross stitch. I was intrigued by the stitched carpets.
So there's a tradition of carpets from the southeast of Portugal, the Alentejo region, from a town called Areolos. And this type of stitching of rugs, it dates back to the presence of the Moors in Portugal. And they people were stitching rugs using a form of cross stitch and using yarn, heavyweight yarn on like a jute-like material, and creating rugs, and often using motifs coming from the Persian rugs that were being traded in Portugal over the years. So that is another fascinating tradition, right? I never would have thought about cross-stitching a rug until I discovered this.
What are they used for a ground cloth for that? Must be a really heavy mesh.
Yeah, it's a jute. I'm forgetting the right word for it. It's a heavy, like potato sack fabric.
Oh, burlap type.
Burlap, exactly. That's what I was looking for. Burlap. Yeah.
Yeah, cross-stitch rug. Yeah, you don't think of that. Not at all. No. So now, and then part of what you do then is these trips, these retreats. Tell how that works and how you connect people who participate with these old cultures.
Mm-hmm. So these retreats are a combination of cultural immersion as best we can, and vacation, and creative workshops. So we spend a week, and it's usually a small group of, up to 8 people. And sometimes we rent a house and we stay in a house together. Sometimes we're in a hotel, just depending on the location. The week is a combination of learning from an embroiderer, visiting weavers' studios, visiting museums, going into people's homes and seeing their private collections, and experiencing the culture. So eating delicious food and, walking on narrow streets and enjoying the architecture and the local sites, wherever we are.
I think that's what makes it interesting when you are able to really see where people live, or, not just be in a, like the big chain hotels, but get out into the country or closer to where people are.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it more interesting.
Yeah, I agree. We try to do that as much as possible and, give people comfort and then also give them a more of an authentic experience.
What do I know? But you haven't been able to do these trips. Are you setting up new ones in 2022?
Yes.
Where are you at with the pandemic?
It's been impossible during the pandemic. And right now I have a trip scheduled this year. So we have a trip to Transylvania, to Budapest, and then to Transylvania in June and also in September. And then 2 trips to Portugal, up to the north, to Viana do Castelo, and then to Areolos, where the rugs are from, in August. So I'm hoping, knock on wood, that it will be possible to do all of those trips. I think things are starting to open up in Europe, and I feel like Portugal should be fine. I feel like Transylvania should be fine too, especially by September, I hope, knock on wood. So, but yeah, they're scheduled now. I'm really hoping that we can go in June. And so, yeah, there are still spaces available if people are interested.
Yeah, that was the other thing. So they're planned and people can sign up, and this is all very active. So if people want to make one of these trips, then they need to get to your website and get signed up then.
Yes, exactly. Please contact me, email me with any questions. And yes, they're open for registration.
Yeah, okay. All right, Beth, there you go.
Yeah. and what intrigues me is that I could see my husband would enjoy that, because when we travel, we always plan on spending at least 3 days in a city, unless it's a huge Paris, London, something like that. And 3 days is like a minimum. I mean, unless you want to go run through the city and leave. I mean, we never like to do that. So a week in a place, it really gives you that opportunity to truly experience the culture, you know, rather than trying to see everything there is to see, which, you know, has its merits, but there's good things about seeing, seeing something different, seeing a culture, I think. I wanted to ask you, Sarah, about your online class night, the creative class, the one where it's one Sunday a week, each one Sunday, and you teach creativity, it looked like. And I was just really curious about that one.
Oh, great. Yeah. So yeah, I have, I teach an art class called Drawing with Thread, which is a month long class, 4 Sundays. I teach that a couple times a year. And that is, with the intention of that is to think more creatively if someone has been embroidering, but they've mostly been working with kits or with patterns, to step out of that and think of the work more like art, like contemporary art. And so we look at the work of a lot of artists and try to branch out a little bit. And that can mean you're still working with patterns, just maybe approaching it differently or putting patterns together differently. So it's not, you don't have to be able to draw, for instance, in order to take that class. And that's a lot of fun. It's always get like a great group of people for that. And then I have a class called Group Practice, which is an extension of that. And the intention for that is to meet just once a month and use it like kind of like a studio visit or an accountability group, that kind of thing. So we meet, and it's also a small group, and the idea is just to check in and talk about what you're doing with your work, and you know, any questions you might have, or you know, to get feedback, problem solving, and that kind of thing.
Right, because I saw that on your Instagram feed, and I was like, I wonder what that is. Posting it, and it got me very curious about that, because I think sometimes as traditional stitchers, people who, you know, we buy kits, we follow the pattern, sometimes there's this desire to move out of that niche, and you know, if I don't have an art background, how do I get out of that? How do I move out?
Yes, exactly. That's the intention exactly for both of those classes, is to figure out, you know, how do I think about this? What are some ideas? And, you know, so my main job is really to be support and to provide inspiration to help people move in that direction.
Right. Well, Beth, you got yourself a couple of online classes and a road trip to Europe. You're set.
There you go.
Yay for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Hard left turn to your own art. What a fascinating approach you take with photography and thread and ink. Where does that come from? Is that just another side of your brain?
Yeah, thank you. And that is a perfect segue from what we were just talking about, because I think, and it loops back around to my history as an artist. So I'm always kind of wanting to do both things. I'm wanting to preserve traditions and really create community through all of this work, like connecting with people over creative practice. So whether that's traditional or making art, making something new. And so my own art practice is really integral to all of this. I use the travel to fuel my art practice, and then my art practice kind of fuels my own work with people supporting other people to make art or to do the traditional work. So photography was my first love, and it's just something that I naturally do all the time. And so it's interesting to come back to that work now after having this big break between COVID and 2009 and that residency where I was there to do photo mixed media. During COVID, I started taking more pictures just out on my daily walks when we were in lockdown here. And so I was taking lots of street scenes and really just what I would find on the sidewalk, like what was left on the sidewalk or someone's window or something on the wall. And so I started using these images to make works that are three-dimensional. So I am stitching through them, and so stitching on paper, they're printed on paper, and then cutting lines and then curling back the paper so the image becomes three-dimensional. And then also using a little bit of ink, a little bit of drawing as well.
Where does the cutting come in? Because it's such a unique approach. Do you have, is there something behind that? Do you put a backing on your photograph, or do you just cut and lift and curl to create shape and texture?
Yeah, it's pretty, it's a little bit fragile. So I'm just working with the paper. I'm not putting any kind of a backing on it. And I was originally working on laser prints because I was just using what I could here at home during lockdown. And I'm now, you know, back to using archival images, archival prints, mm-hmm. and working with those. So that paper is a little bit heavier, but it's still pretty lightweight. And there's something that I really like about that, about it being a bit fragile. It slows down the process. Like working with textiles, like any kind of stitching, it's a slow process. And I have to be, you know, careful about my decisions and what I'm doing as I work. And so it's, in the way that stitching is so meditative, I think this process of kind of collaging together different elements and making choices about what is cut and what is stitched and what is drawn with ink, becomes a really interesting kind of contemplative process.
Yeah, and you don't use a lot of thread in these things.
No, it's pretty minimalistic. It's really about reducing something to a line or a contour. And I'm using very basic stitches. I'm just using backstitch or stem stitch. And I think my work has always been, my art practice has always been about line. Going back to what I made in graduate school, I was working with materials and drawing with materials in a sense. So I'm doing that, continue to do that, just in a different way. And I'm pulling imagery, like the sourcing for these lines that I'm cutting and drawing is all imagery that's coming from textiles, it's coming from these different traditions that I'm studying. And so the process feels like a form of mapping in a sense, in a kind of in an abstract way of putting together these different elements and connecting them like points on a map. Or like constellations. It's also, I talk about it in terms of wayfinding and placemaking. So as a foreigner, as an American living in a different country, living in Amsterdam, when I'm out and taking photos, I feel like the photo itself is a way of marking and mapping my own environment here. And then the actual drawing, cutting, drawing, stitching that I'm doing is a different kind of mapping that's laid on the surface of that. And then there's a peeling back, like in the way that I'm really interested in history with the traditional embroidery, I'm very much interested in like the history of this place and wishing I could, you know, peel back the bricks on the street and see, you know, what's buried beneath, especially in this city in Amsterdam, which is built on a swamp. And there, you know, there are, who knows what's buried in the swamp.
Right. And I noticed on Instagram, you're, you were doing like a postcard series where you were stitching on like postcards that you had,
yes,
purchased in your travel.
Yes. So yes, this is a kind of a recent, project that I started where I'm working with postcards that are mostly from so far from Central Europe. So Slovakia and, mostly Slovakia actually in the Czech Republic right now are the ones that I'm using. And, yeah, so I'm doing the same kind of process that I do with my photos, but working with these cards, that show people in traditional dress. So it's also feels like another way of mapping and kind of a nice allusion to tourism, right? Working with an actual postcard. And these are older postcards too. The ones that I have are mostly from the 70s. So they're a little bit older. So there's that kind of historical document element to it as well.
What fun. Well, there we have it, folks. The boring one-dimensional Sarah Pedlow right there. nothing going on with her.
Something else going on. Yeah.
Wow. She sleeps from midnight to 2 a.m. and then after that, she's up in Adam. That's boy, what a ride. That's fun on all aspects. And really applaud you for keeping these old traditions alive and, you know, bringing them to light and making sure that people know about them, because that's, I mean, it's our history, it's our culture, and it needs to be preserved. So bravo for that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And I appreciate you bringing them to the United States through your workshops that, you know, sharing that love of stitching with us. It's a great joy because I did listen to your lecture through EGA and you did offer a class through them. And
yes,
it's just very, it's great that you are offering that.
Thank you. Yeah. I really enjoy working with the EGA and other institutions, museums and nonprofits to offer classes. And I think that's such a part of who we are as Americans, you know, that most of us have come from somewhere else, right? So I think connecting with textile traditions and learning to stitch from your own heritage, from another country, I think is just such a beautiful way to, to connect with your heritage, with your ancestors.
Yes. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Yep. Thank you, Sarah. And thanks to everyone for listening.